Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Democratic Party has been working hard this year to try and rebuild confidence and optimism after the many defeats of the 2016 election. The Woodbury County Democratic Party is holding its second annual Harry Hopkins Democratic Dinner and Celebration this Saturday night. Jeremy Dumkrieger is the leader of the Woodbury County Democrats. He says the event is basically to raise money and awareness.
This year we're having Senator Tom Harkin, who retired a couple years ago. It's going to be on Saturday, October 21st, and it starts at 6 o'clock with a little social hour, happy hour, just a gathering of people to talk and have a little fun. Then at 7 o'clock we have dinner by Tutoria Fresco, and it should be a good time, and the program will start shortly thereafter.
Are you also going to have some candidates at this event?
We are. We're going to have all four district four congressional candidates there: J.D. Scholten, Paul Dahl, Leanne Jacobson, and Dr. John Passion will also be in attendance. We're also going to have surrogates from the Nate Bolton campaign. Andrea, his wife, is coming up to talk for him. John Norris for governor. We're having Jackie Norris, his wife, will be here speaking. And she was actually Michelle Obama's chief of staff, which is fascinating. And also for Andy McGuire for governor campaign, we have Mike Gronstahl. So it's a pretty good lineup. Also, we have John Delaney, Congressman John Delaney, who's going to use for Maryland. And he will be there to speak, and he's actually the first declared candidate for president.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. I heard that he was. And he's not very well known for that yet, so it's kind of a good forum for him. What are your goals for the event?
Well, our goal is essentially to, two things, really. Just one, to raise money for the party so that we can continue to have outreach for Democratic candidates to win elections, but also just the gathering to sort of celebrate all the work we've done. You know, we took a pretty good shellacking this last year. But we've been working really hard getting people together and coming out and resisting, as they say, but also just community building, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
I know when I talked to you earlier this year, you talked a little bit about the need to, get up and say, what are we going to do now to be an active participant and not just saying, oh, isn't this terrible, what happened to us?
Right. So what we're doing now is just essentially we're just community building, and it's still happening. Of course, we have the special election that's coming up. We still haven't heard exactly when that's going to be, but we're preparing for that, getting our district convention in sight, lined up, and again, we don't know when that's going to be either, but we're ready to pull the trigger when it does happen.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the person this is named after, Harry Hopkins, and sort of why he's the honoree of this?
Sure. Well, Harry Hopkins was born in Sioux City, Iowa, and he was basically one of the key factors in not only during the Depression era with the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, but also just FDR's right-hand man when it came to running World War II.
Right.
Essentially. And he was here, and we're just ready to honor him. I even believe one of the school work centers is named after him as well. Just really a key factor. People really don't know who he is. He's been almost forgotten, so we're just trying to highlight him and just kind of claim him as our own.
Right, right. And we have another guest here today to talk about Harry Hopkins. And Gary Lipschutz, you know an awful lot about Harry Hopkins, don't you? What is it about Harry Hopkins that makes him so unique?
Well, I think I'm fascinated by him because when you realize that here's a person that was born in Sioux City on August 17th, 1890, and he was born on 10th Street between Pierce and Nebraska, and that the man literally changed the world that we live in. I mean, it's just a phenomenal thing that somebody born, his dad was a harness maker in Sioux City, and probably if you were named 10 people in the 20th century that changed the world, he'd be one of them.
What do you think it was about Harry Hopkins that made him basically FDR's, right-hand person?
Well, he was extremely tough, and he was very able. And he was able to motivate people to work for what he considered was a noble cause. And that's everything from the relief projects of the 30s to basically he was sick. So Roosevelt said, why don't you stay in the White House? And he wound up living there for 3 years and essentially did the nuts and bolts of World War II from an office in the White House.
So he went from administering a lot of the WPA projects back in the Depression to working on some of the tough issues of World War II.
The two issues that I think he's most famous for in World War II is because Roosevelt couldn't travel easily, so he always would send Hopkins just basically to represent him. So there was the Grand Coalition with Great Britain and the Soviet Union, and essentially Hopkins put that together. And then I think when we look at one of the reasons we won World War II is our ability to produce. And Hopkins basically, there were different titles, but basically he oversaw war production. And I don't think there's anybody that's a student of history that wouldn't say that America's war production is one of the reasons we won World War II.
He also was very effective as a mediator, you were telling me before.
Yeah, I think people trusted him, and he was very direct. But, you know, when I think back, when you read about history and you realize all the egos of the generals that he had to work with, and then working with Joseph Stalin and Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, Charles de Gaulle, the idea that he could bring those people together on a common cause and force them to make decisions that they had to make, he's truly a phenomenal person in history.
If he were alive today, what do you think he would say about what needs to happen in the world? What do you think he would think would be a good thing to happen?
Well, one of the things I think is he always felt that he believed in democracy, so he'd be very, very concerned about any infringement on any democratic institution. He was also very, very interested in economic justice. I think he'd be concerned if he were alive today about health care. You know, he's one of the architects of Social Security. So if people in Sioux City don't know who he is, if you're on Social Security and you get that check every month, you might thank the guy born on 10th Street.
And Harry Hopkins was instrumental in creating and running the WPA, which built a lot of projects around Siouxland in the 1930s.
Many younger people in Sioux City don't realize what are WPA and Depression era projects. And what was started, what he built, it was called Public School Stadium. Then it was Roberts Stadium. Now it's Olson Stadium. But when you go out and see a major college or high school football game all these years, or track meets, city track meets, that is a Depression era project. Memorial Drive, which is the road to Sloan Park, that's the WPA project. The shelters in Stone Park are CCC, which is a Depression-era project. And here's one that every day thousands of Sioux Citians use, is you go over the viaduct from downtown to Morningside, and a lot of that was funded by Depression-era money. And you have Hubbard Park, and then there's some Depression things that are now been replaced, like the swimming pool in Morningside, Leif Erickson Park. There are newer swimming pools, but the originals were WPA pools. The state of Iowa did the 100 best buildings of the 20th century, and one of them is the Grandview Bandshell, which is a WPA project. So thanks for reminding me about that, Jeremy.
That was local historian Gary Lipschutz. I spoke with him and also Jeremy Dumkrieger, the leader of the Woodbury County Democratic Party. The second annual Harry Hopkins Democratic Dinner is being held Saturday night from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Carpenters Union Hall in Sioux City. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Tyson Foods is involved in a new program that chooses paid interns from local colleges and universities and pairs them with nonprofits. The Tyson Foods Summer Community Internship Program is now taking applications for these internships that begin next summer. The Iowa Campus Compact, which promotes community involvement and civic responsibility for college students, is also working on this project. Emily Shields is with the Iowa Campus Compact. She says students from all over Siouxland are eligible for the program.
We will be selecting nonprofit and public organizations in Sioux City, Council Bluffs, and Storm Lake. And then any student who is a full-time college student, going to be returning full-time in the fall of 2018, from really any college or university can participate. Anyone who wants to spend the summer working in one of those communities. So we do think most of them will be students from colleges and universities in those communities, but it's certainly possible there will be students either from those communities going to school elsewhere or just people interested in working there that could take those positions also.
Has this been tried in any other area so far?
We have done different versions of this, and other organizations have supported it as well. So there are definitely other examples of funding to support nonprofit internships. So it's a good model. I think where we're adding value is our emphasis with the nonprofits. We'll be working with them on developing really quality positions. So we know that internships can be powerful for students, but they aren't always. If a student is doing a lot of administrative work only and that kind of thing, they'll learn some from that, but not really at the level that we're hoping for. So one of the things we're going to be looking for in the applications from organizations is the quality of that experience, and then we'll also be working with those organizations to build that quality. We'll be providing additional training to the students as well throughout the summer. And that's really going to focus on how they can build those soft or core skills that employers are looking for through this experience.
And those soft skills are so important. Sometimes students can be straight-A students and do all these things, but if they don't have those soft skills, sometimes it's hard for them to get along in life.
I agree. One of my favorite things to say is that you can't really teach someone how to interact with people without having them interact with people. And sometimes the college experience doesn't really always facilitate that. You know, you can go through, like you said, get straight A's and not really interact with anyone different than you. So giving people those opportunities to build those communication skills, critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills, and nonprofits are really fertile ground for learning that. They will give these students a lot to do because there's a lot to be done.
So if a student wants to become involved with this, what can they do or what should they do to apply or find out more information?
Yeah, so our website is iacampuscompact.org, and we do right now have a student application up that they can complete. That will be sort of the priority application pool, and then when we have nonprofits selected, we will send them those applications in their area. And the nonprofits will do the selecting from there. We really want them to pick someone that's a good fit for their organization and for what they're looking for over the summer. So students can start applying anytime, and then we'll be getting their information to the nonprofits to really start that interview process later in November.
That was Emily Shields, the coordinator of the Iowa College Compact. That program matches college interns with local nonprofits. The Compact is working with Tyson Foods for its summer community internship program. Garrett Dolan is with Tyson Foods, where he's the senior manager for corporate social responsibility. Dolan says the dual goal of the program is to connect with the community and also to specifically match interns to local organizations and help them further their future careers.
Ideally, you know, we would want a student, you know, for example, if it's studying computer skills or it may be studying a foreign language, to find an internship with a nonprofit that needs someone that has computer skills or that needs someone that has foreign language skills, so that they'd actually get to practice what they're studying and practice in a professional setting what they're actually studying. So that's really important, and that's where we spend our time trying to pre-qualify everybody to make sure that it's a meaningful experience. And then while they're having the internship experience itself, it's important for us also to make sure that they're in a nonprofit organization that will support them, that, you know, they're new to the workplace, they may not understand, you know, norms of communications and so on. And so we want them to get support from the nonprofit itself, and we'll be also providing three training sessions throughout their 2-month internship on communication skills, soft skills, resume building skills, to help them prepare to become a professional in the workforce, you know, overall. And while all that's going on, we're asking the students themselves to be talking about their experience. You know, what specifically are they doing, you know, to help their nonprofit? And my hope is, my expectation is that, you know, marketing students will be talking about how they're helping their nonprofit, you know, raise money, and computer students will be talking about how they're helping their nonprofit create a database.
We certainly have a lot of, you know, workers for Tyson and other meatpacking companies up here in Northwest Iowa. A lot of these people are new to the country. They're immigrants. I imagine that the company itself has learned a lot about what these newcomers have to go through when they come to the United States.
Yes, as you can imagine, being a newcomer, an immigrant to any country, or imagine yourself going to China, for example, and you may not know the language, and you may not be able to read it, or you may not have a driver's license. You know, all of those issues that where to go to the grocery store and so on. All of those issues are true for people that come to our country for the first time. And if we can help a nonprofit who provides those services to help any immigrant or any person kind of navigate their lives, navigate through some of the complexities of healthcare, for example, then that's a really valuable service that these students can provide. And we know there's nonprofits out there doing that, and so this is one way we want to help them.
That was Garrett Dolan. He's with Tyson Foods, where he's the senior manager for corporate social responsibility. Dolan spoke about the Tyson Foods Summer Community Internship Program that begins next summer. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, it's almost Halloween, and a lot of people like to visit haunted houses to celebrate the holiday. Some even visit houses where terrible crimes have been committed, like the one in the small southwest Iowa town of Villisca. It's home to a very famous, quote-unquote, murder house. The Villisca axe murders occurred there between the evening of June 9th, 1912, and the early morning of the next day. 6 members of the Moore family and 2 house guests were found killed in the house. The crime remains unsolved. The Moore's house has become a big draw for visitors from around the world who pay to spend a night in the house or just go for a tour. Martha Innes is the proprietor. She says Halloween is an especially busy season for her, and she's booked through the end of the month. Martha says the process of turning the very old house into a tourist site was a long and difficult one.
My husband and I purchased the property in 1994, and that's how long we've had. That's how long we've been working on getting it back and getting it up and running and getting it popular. So,
what kind of shape was it in when you purchased it?
Terrible state. You can't imagine. Somebody had lived in it up until a couple of years when we bought it. Since the murders in 1912, different people had lived in it, and therefore it had been, as different families lived in it, it was modernized. It was green siding put on it. The structure of the actual house was altered. And so we had a lot of work to get it back to what it looked like in 1912. So
when did you open up for business?
Well, it probably took a couple of years. We started giving tours to the place in 1996 or 97. I'm not exactly sure of the year, which year it was. But it took a while. It took a lot of work to get it And we used our own money, so, you know, you did it as you had the money to do it. And there's not any taxpayers' money in this project. It's all private funds. It's all my husband and my funds. And so it took a while to get it done.
What did you think the reaction would be to having this place fixed up and inviting people in? Seems like it's been very positive over, you know, over the years. You've really built up a lot of goodwill. A lot of people know about it and go there, and even you have overnights there as well, right?
Well, at first the people in Villisca weren't too happy with us. They thought maybe we were trying to capitalize on the murders of the Moore family, and but it was a piece of Villisca history. It's in the history books. Everybody knows about it anyway. And we were just trying to preserve the house because it had been up for sale and nobody was buying it, and the property was getting run down. So probably anybody else that bought it would just have torn it down and put up a new structure, a new home on that lot. So we actually saved the house for posterity, you know, for people to come and see and wonder about. So
what do you think about the murders? They've never been solved. I'm sure you've heard a lot of theories about them, though.
Well, there are lots of theories out there, and I don't give one. I wasn't here in 1912. I can only read what everybody else reads, and I don't offer up a suggestion or a theory to anybody. I let them form their own opinions.
I assume you have people coming there that are looking, some of them anyway, looking for ghosts.
That's right. There's paranormal investigators. That's probably the most popular thing that people come to do now. When we purchased the property, we purchased it for the historic value only, because we didn't have any idea what the paranormals and all that kind of thing was even about. So when the first paranormal team decided to come and do an investigation, and they thought they had found something, then the news media got a hold of it, and people who are into doing paranormal investigations, they got into it, and it's just taken on a life all of its own.
Is there like a barn or something?
Well, the barn is part of the property. When the Moores lived there, they had a barn. We used to have a museum downtown, and when my husband passed away, then I had to get rid of the museum. So we had to have a place for an office and our souvenirs thing. So we modernized the barn to the extent where I have an office and a souvenir shop in the barn. We have electricity and a bathroom in the barn so that when people come to spend the night, there is no modern facilities in the house, but they do have that in the barn. So
they do stay in the house.
Yes, they stay right in the house, most of them, I think. I don't stay with them. When they come, they sign in, and they pay their fee, and they get a tour, and they get the keys, and then they are allowed to spend the rest of the time there by themselves.
Do they bring their own bedding and et cetera?
They have to bring their own sleeping bags or air mattresses. Yes, they do. Nobody minds.
What kind of response do they have in the morning? Do they ever have tales to tell?
Well, I have a couple of notebooks in the basket that are full of, I leave a notebook there, and they're free to write down what they've experienced in the night if they want to. Not everybody does, but I have quite a few testimonials as to what went on for them during the night, and some will say nothing happened, and others will go into full detail of everything they went through during the evening. So I have written words from people that have spent the night there, yes.
Do you think that these are true accounts? Do you think these things really happened?
Well, now, I'm not about to call anybody that's staying there by themselves at night without my being there. I'm not going to call them a liar. You know, I don't have the right to do that. They're putting down on that paper what they feel like they want to tell me. And so I'm going to believe what they tell me.
Right. Well, I'm wondering, sometimes people say, oh, it was your imagination, it was a dark house, and you just thought you saw that.
Well, how do I know? I wasn't there with them, so I'm not knowing what they're experiencing.
Good point.
So I have to take them at their word, and I do. They write those down. They write their feelings and what they've experienced. They write that down for me to experience, and it's there for anybody that wants to read it that comes on and comes to spend the night. So,
how many people do you get in a year? Say, how many people have you had so far this year? Do you know off the bat?
I haven't counted them yet. Some months are, you know, December is a Christmas month. People are really busy. So it's probably one of our least active months. I'm full every night this month. I have quite a few bookings for November. I have very few evenings or night times in November. And for the rest of the months of the year, you know, it's probably 80% full.
Is this your busiest time of the year around Halloween?
Well, I think there's a fascination with the paranormal world and anything spooky in the month of Halloween, with all the movies, with all the TV shows, with all the things that you see in the store windows, and you know, you can go and buy about anything in the month of October that has to be do with spooks and things like that. So I think Halloween tends to be probably a busier time of the month of the year. Yes.
Have you ever been afraid in the house?
No.
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 You probably spent quite a lot of time there, so.
Well, I would say being the owner gives me that prerogative, yes.
Right. So, but you've never felt anything, you know.
I didn't tell you that. I didn't say that. I said I have never been afraid in the house. You didn't ask me if I'd ever felt anything in the house.
Ah, okay.
So.
Okay.
I guess there's a difference there, you know.
So maybe you have felt something in the house.
Well, I would have to say that, yes, I've had some experiences in the house, yes. But they weren't anything that frightened me. You know, we have people from all walks of life. I mean, absolutely all walks of life. From doctors, college professors, teachers, nurses, priests, preachers, I mean, we have people really from every walk of life that have been through that house and experienced it. So I don't know what more anybody could ask for. We have the common people. We have the so it's an experience. It's an experience to just spend the night in a house that has no electricity and running water and a bathroom. So, you know, some people just get a kick out of that.
Yeah, like living like a, you know, a pioneer kind of thing.
Living back in great grandma's time. And the fact that there's no electricity in the house is spooky on itself. So you don't have to hear a little noise and you probably could be freaked out.
Well, and to go to the bathroom, right, they have to go over to the barn?
Yes, they do.
Oh, okay. Well, that could be scary in and of itself.
It's just a few feet from the house. The barn is... you can almost reach out and touch the barn, so it's no big deal to walk out of the house and into the barn. So I get people from everywhere. I even had a young couple from India, they come from Colorado, they come from Texas, they come from Minnesota, Illinois, Wisconsin, Missouri, Alabama, Arkansas. I mean, if I went through my list, there would be very few states that I would miss. Having someone have been here this year or in the past couple of, you know, past few years. So it's a destination for a lot of people. Some people are just, you know, they're going through Iowa, so they get the travel guide and they look and see what they can see on the way through. And some of them, the Axe Murder House is their destination.
That was Martha Innes, the owner of the Villisca Murder House in southwest Iowa. The house is open year-round, and there are tours there daily and overnight stays available as well. Next week on The Exchange, we'll have part two of our look at the Villisca Murder House. We talk with the co-author of a new book that posits a theory that the murders were actually committed by a traveling serial killer. That's next week on The Exchange, here on Siouxland Public Media. Thank you. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Soul Searching, Seeking Faith and Spirituality in Siouxland, is a new segment with Molly and Ryan Dowell Baum. Through it, they seek to introduce Siouxlanders to the diversity of faith and spirituality and to discover the many ways faith and spirituality are a force for good in Siouxland and beyond. Ryan and Molly are a clergy couple who have called Sioux City home since 2013. Molly is a musical theater artist by training, a Presbyterian minister by ordination, and is currently occupied full-time as a radical homemaker and parent of their two phenomenal little kids. Ryan is the pastor of First Congregational United Church of Christ and the host of Beer and Theology, a forum for the exploration of spiritual and theological themes on Sunday afternoons on Jackson Street Brewing in Sioux City. Their guest today is Mark Sheffer, a writer with the Baha'i International Community United Nations Office. He lives in Sioux City. Mark plays with the Sioux City Symphony, studies the martial art of judo, and spends a good amount of his time thinking about the spiritual, social, and material advancement of society. Now here's that segment.
I am Molly Dowell Baum, along with Ryan Dowell Baum.
Hello.
We are doing our first ever episode of Soul Searching, Seeking Faith and Spirituality in Siouxland. And today we are here with Mark Sheffer, who is a member of the Baha'i community here in Sioux City.
Welcome. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
For some who may not know, what is the Baha'i Faith?
The Baha'i Faith is an independent world religion whose central objective is to unite all of the peoples of the world into one common people and to draw from the power of that unity to bring about the spiritual and material advancement of humankind.
These are big and beautiful ideas.
<They're> big.
What do they look like in practice? What do you do as a Baha'i?
Right. So I think the teachings of Baha'u'llah in a way are centered on what could be described as kind of a twofold moral purpose. One, to transform our inner character, and two, to contribute to the advancement of society. For example, service to others and to society would be very central in this regard. So service is understood to be a means that we can advance both of those at once, both our own personal refinement and the betterment of society. So the Baha'i Holy Writings in one place say, think ye of rendering some service to every member of the human race. So that's kind of in a personal capacity. And then how can I also assist others to also arise in service to the common good? So things like teaching classes for the spiritual education of children, providing for the kind of spiritual empowerment of young adolescents, being youth and adults, kind of systematically think about how do we take high and noble ideals and apply them to our own lives and to the lives of and to the life of society. I mean, there's a lot of things. Sort of daily prayer, Baha'is would understand as being essential in providing us with sort of the spiritual and moral impetus to keep on this path, to sustain ourselves. So sort of daily prayer, the Baha'i Holy Writings talk about prayer being like spiritual food, that just as we need to provide our material body with physical food every day, we provide our spiritual body with spiritual food.
Do you have a daily prayer practice in your family or yourself?
Baha'u'llah enjoins his followers to pray at least twice a day, every morning and every evening. So the only way I can make it happen in the morning is to get up quite early. So that's the way I make that happen. And then when I go to bed at night, but there's also this understanding that prayer is not just something that functions at the individual level, but also at the collective level, that increasingly, if we are to bring about sort of the kind of civilization that God wants for humanity, sort of our community needs to increasingly be characterized by this sort of devotional spirit.
And you don't meet every Sunday. You have a 19-day cycle, is that right?
So like the other religions, the Baha'i Faith has a calendar, which is structured in 19 months of 19 days each, which if you multiply it out, leaves about 4 or 5 left every year. So there's sort of this special time of celebration, preparation for the upcoming year. So Baha'is gather once every Baha'i month, once every 19 days.
I've seen this flyer around town of celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birth of Baha'u'llah, and it looks like it's coming up this weekend, Friday, October 20th and then Saturday, Sunday, the 21st and the 22nd. Can you tell us who is Baha'u'llah and why is your community celebrating him?
Baha'u'llah is the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith. So he was born in 1817, 200 years ago, which is why we're celebrating this bicentenary. Born in Tehran, what would be Persia at the time, what is Iran today. So Baha'is would see Baha'u'llah as the latest in this line of divine messengers bringing God's word and guidance to humanity. So this would include other figures such as Krishna, Zoroaster, Moses, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad. So we would understand the Baha'i faith to be kind of the most recent expression of what could be understood as not a bunch of different religions, but just one overarching religion that has been unfolding over time.
As these different divine messengers, do you worship each of them? Or you mentioned you see them as a prophet. Do you worship Baha'u'llah?
Right. So Baha'is would see all of these, the founders of the major world's religions, as being divine figures, as being expressions of the divine will, of their revelation as being the word of God, as is Baha'u'llah's. So we would understand Baha'u'llah to be kind of the promised one, which each of these past messengers sort of foretold, and that Baha'u'llah's sort of mission is to bring the teachings and principles from God that are addressed to the challenges and possibilities that humanity is facing today, as previous messengers brought revelations sort of suited to the needs of that age.
Tell us more about this celebration. How will you celebrate, and who's it for, and who's invited?
Yeah, so everyone is invited. We're really trying to think about it not in terms of just inviting participants, but approaching everyone as co-hosts. So people are welcome to come, bring their thoughts and observations and insights, bring their friends. These celebrations are taking place all over the globe for these 2 days. So here in Sioux City, we have 3 events, as Molly mentioned earlier. On the Friday evening, there's going to be a devotional program. So it's going to be kind of an arts-based prayer gathering in a way, sort of the reading of prayers and holy writings, song. There's going to be a devotional dance by our own Molly Dowell-Baum.
Oh, yes. So speaking of co-hosting.
And that will be at the Pierce Mansion. On Saturday evening is kind of the more gala reception affair, if you will. So this is going to be at the Morningside College Lincoln Business Center. We're going to have a couple presentations about sort of the life and person of Baha'u'llah, the history of the Baha'i faith in sort of the Northwest Iowa area, which is actually fascinating and quite significant, more so than people might imagine. And then that will also have kind of an exploration of the principle of the oneness of humankind. What does this mean? What is the relevance of it? Kind of, instead of having just someone on the stage talk to people about things, we wanted to have a space where people could actually explore together a little bit. And then on the Sunday, we're having a screening of a film that has been produced specifically for the bicentenary at the Baha'i World Center that's looking at kind of how have communities all around the world in very different settings, how are they working to translate some of these teachings that Baha'u'llah brought into action in their local circumstances? And what is that looking like? What new possibilities is that opening? And what can we do together to sort of try to advance that?
If someone wants to find out more about the Baha'i community, where should they go?
We have a Sioux City website, SiouxCityBaha'is.org, but we actually keep up our Facebook account a little bit better. So just search for Sioux City Baha'is on Facebook. And
how do you spell Baha'is?
B-A-H-A-I-S.
Thank you very much, Mark. We're looking forward to celebrating with you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Mural Project is bringing more public art to the downtown area. The large-scale paintings are expected to complement the outdoor sculptures and create a more inviting environment. Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson met up with the artists to learn more.
Argentinian artist Martin Ron has painted a mural of a man and his dog sitting under a giant sea turtle in Buenos Aires. He's painted people picnicking on the tail of a shark in Benalla, Australia. And now he's working on painting two people lounging on top of a buffalo in downtown Sioux City. His art can be found in the streets of England, Belgium, Estonia, Malaysia, and Thailand. He only has one other mural in the United States, and that's in Miami. And yet he was excited to come here, calling it an exotic place.
Yes, when I investigation about Sioux City, say, oh, good, that is exotic, because it's the only way to know this place. I am from Buenos Aires. If I
Ron is searching for the right words to say. Spanish is his first language. His assistant, Ramiro Smith Estrada, jumps in for clarification.
It's not like your regular point of
claro, it's not regular
destination
point.
For tourism. So
yeah, it's more interesting.
But it's nice too, because you get to, in a way, know this like the real USA in a way. Because it's, I mean, you usually go to New York, Miami, big cities, you know. But I think this is more a representation of actual America.
And it's quiet. I am. O sea, me vine también como unas buenas vacaciones.
It's like a good holiday too, because it's quiet. Buenos Aires has 10 million people living there,
sí.
So it's always a rush and mess.
Everywhere he goes, Ron tries to capture the personality of the city. The people, architecture, and history of a place inspire his surrealistic compositions. Elements of fantasy fuse with everyday life. Another defining feature of his work is its size alone, adding to the visual impact. The buffalo in Sioux City is no exception. It will cover one wall of a three-story building on the corner of 5th and Douglas.
Cuando fue invitado para pintar en Sioux City,
before coming here, like he always does, before going to any specific point, he makes some research online to get to know the history of the place where he's going. The buffalo just keeps showing up and showing up, and it became a way like a symbol of, I think, of the place and of the area.
A second mural is being created by Des Moines area artist Jenna Brownlee in the historic 4th Street District. Both artists were commissioned by Downtown Partners, which received a $25,000 grant from the Gilchrist Foundation to support the Sioux City Mural Project. Their murals are set to be finished by the end of the month. Reagan Cody, executive director of Downtown Partners, said that the purpose of the project is to help make downtown more inviting with eye-catching, thought-provoking, interactive public art.
Art anywhere, even in your home, in your business, in your community, it just adds an element of creativity and innovation.
While Ron is an established muralist, Brownlee just started doing large-scale works this year. She is a professional graphic designer and runs a small business on the side, specializing in watercolors. But like Ron's concept, her mural borrows from past representations of Sioux City while looking to future revitalization.
The design includes historical landmarks from Sioux City that were established in the early 20th century, including the Grandview Bandshell, the Woodbury Courthouse, the Veterans Bridge over the river, the Floyd Monument, and a few others.
It also incorporates a collage of florals and typography, which are both part of her signature style.
It will say, "This is Sioux City," which is sort of just a bold statement and kind of captures the vibrancy of the community. And I like for my work to encourage people to stop and smell the roses.
Her mural can be found on the side of M's on 4th. She hopes the bright pinks, reds, and yellows draw people in to take a closer look and maybe stop and take a selfie. This kind of interaction is what drives Ron's work, too.
He prefers working on the street rather than in a gallery or in a closed environment. Yeah, he prefers this interaction that working in the street brings out with the people from the city itself. His own works is like providing him this opportunity to know the world.
And in the end, his work can't be bought and sold. It belongs to the community. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Ellie Carson.